Barbara Peters. Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Calendar. I'm not sure if I have total control, or in fact any control, over our guest today, Don Winslow. What could you say?
I don't know. You've always had total control over me. It's scary.
Yeah. But one of the things I love about you is your own wry look at yourself. You are the master of self-deprecation, and yet, you know, it's you're so wonderful that I'm not quite sure how we do this dynamic.
I have a lot to be self-deprecating about, so it's an endless well, a bottomless well.
While you're in the frequent trenches that have beset your literary career.
Beset my career, yes, deep down in those trenches, occasionally with a periscope, you know, looking up and over, deciding whether to attack the next wire, I suppose, to torture that metaphor.
You know, but I don't think you could ever, like, leave the battlefield. I see you as sort of perpetually stranded in Flanders, you know, back to World War I. You're kind of on that. But truly, you know, you are also a master of reinvention. You started out with your Edgar-nominated book, The Cool Breeze on the Underground,
right,
which was an absolute classic and still is a classic, and apparently is going to be a movie.
As they say, soon to be a major motion picture, yeah. Starts filming this summer.
That's so exciting.
It is, after 13 years. It's been under option to the movies for 13 years.
And has the cast evolved over time?
Oh, yeah, because originally they cast, John Barrymore or something?
No, neither one of us is that old.
Most of them died, you know, so now they've gone on to live actors, which I think is a good choice. I think they'll make it a better film.
Yes, dead actors are like the Dead Poets Society,
So
good. But who's the current candidate for Neil Caring?
Nick Stahl, who's on an HBO series called Carnival, and was in, like, the Terminator movies or something. You know, I don't go to movies, so...
And I haven't turned on my TV for a sports event or something.
They email me pictures of these people and say, this is the guy. And then I ask my son about him, and he says, yeah, I know who he is.
It's so interesting, because Neil Carey is basically a graduate student, right?
Right.
He goes to England.
Perpetual graduate student.
Yeah. I mean, he's found a way to kind of spin off growing up, and it's like Peter Pan, kind of, revisited in graduate school.
That's odd, isn't it?
I see no parallel there. No autobiography thing. No, but truly, he'd be an interesting character to cast because, you know, he is a graduate student in English, right?
English Lit, 18th century English literature.
Which is not your obvious background for a hero.
No.
So he has to kind of sneak up on the detecting parts, right?
Right. Well, he was, as a kid, you know, raised as a street kid and had this sort of curmudgeon that taught him all these street skills, but then they also gave him an education so they could sort of use him at a higher level. And so he goes to private school and goes to Columbia, and now he's doing his master's degree, except cases keep intervening.
I love it. And who is his big project? He's writing, if I remember right, he's doing a thesis or a study on...
He's writing a biography of Smollett.
Oh, Smollett, that's it. I love it. Tobias Smollett.
Tobias Smollett.
Not one of your luminary giants, but nevertheless.
Oh, I beg to differ.
Okay.
I think one of the pivotal people in English literature.
What are his works?
Peregrine Pickle, Roderick Random, and Humphrey Clinker.
I remember Humphrey Clinker. God, he was a master of alliteration, too, wasn't he?
He was a master of a lot of things.
I
look at the modern detective novel as the picaresque novel of our times. There's so many things in common. And so when I was writing Neil Carey, I made him a picaresque character. He's illegitimate child. Never really knew his mother, who was a heroin addict, is raised in the streets, and then, like a picaresque character, he has to go through all these different identities and guises to eventually discover who he really is.
Fighting dragons on the way,
and tilting at windmills, and always perpetually on a quest.
Right.
And so that was the idea behind the Neil Carey series. It really was a picaresque novel.
Oh, it is classic BI. I mean, you know, you can go all the way back to the obvious imagery in The Big Sleep and Chandler, where clearly Philip Marlowe, you know, is up there with the... and I once had a fabulous discussion on this very program with James Lee Burke about Mallory and Le Morte d'Arthur.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dave Robichaud is kind of a modern Knight of the Round Table with a fouler mouth. Or maybe not. It's sort of hard to tell changes in English, but...
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I think it is the private eye novel is, as you say, it tends to be the lone guy, often against the system, generally on a sort of hopeless quest, often with a maiden to protect, usually with dragons.
mob dragons, cop dragons, all kinds of dragons out there.
So I can see why it appealed to you. And then Neil went on to one of, actually still my favorite of all your books, although I love all your books, but The Trail to Buddha's Mirror, his second book, really spoke to me, and I'm not sure whether it was the whole scenes in Hong Kong or whether it was the fabulous ending where he went off, you know, to find truth on the mountaintop or what. What was the inspiration for the second book?
You know, I don't remember how that book ends, so you might have to tell me during this interview. The inspiration was, you know, I was earning my living as a safari guide in those days.
This was after you were the usher in the movie theater?
Yeah. Yeah. And,
I love your career. It's just so much fun.
Yeah, the trenches, you know. But I was transferred from Kenya to China for a year and was leading hiking trips up the mountains described in Buddha's Mirror.
Which are where? Are they in southern China? Are they
southwestern China, Sichuan province.
Oh, in Sichuan. Okay.
Yeah, way out in the foothills of the Himalayas. And so I went up and down that mountain a lot. And you know, I was trying to launch a career as a writer. And so after Neil Carey went to England, then I thought, well, where next? So I'd like to bring him to China. And so that was the inspiration for that book.
Did you actually have a second book? I mean, are you one of those writers, like most writers who wrote the first book, never thinking about what came next because you were so not hopeful about getting it published?
I was so ignorant about all of this that I didn't realize when I wrote Cool Breeze that you did series of books.
Well, you don't always.
Characters. You don't always, and in fact, I haven't lately. But, so no, I didn't have it in mind at all.
So there's always, I mean, it seems to me, I've talked to, as you know, hundreds of writers.
Yeah.
And most of the time, there's always this kind of scramble for book two. I mean, you can see this kind of desperate look in the eye, or, you know, the writer will say, well, my editor said, what's the next book about character, whatever, and suddenly, you know, came the light that I have to come up with one.
You know, I finished Cool Breeze, and publishers were not exactly leaping off cliffs to buy it. You know,
true.
Turned down 14 times, and it's everybody's story.
Was it really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was turned down by everybody.
I wonder if it was the graduate student PI nexus.
They said I had no niche.
Well, but that's actually always been your most wonderful quality. No, not a problem. I've always thought it was your most wonderful quality, but I can understand from a New York publisher standpoint that might be a detraction. For mine, it's an asset.
Well, one of them said he didn't know if it was a novel or a psychotic break.
That's one of those things where you just busted through the barbed wire in the trench, right? And there you were. Well,
so while I was waiting, you know, for the next rejection, then I had discovered that you could do a series of books with the same character that nobody wanted. And so in classic fashion, this book not selling at all, the first one, I, of course, decided to write the second one. So I was in, you know, just out of, you know, defiance. Well,
right.
if you didn't like that book, wait till you see how much you hate this one.
There's so much of the kid in you still. I just love this.
Well, you know, I've said it before. You know, I was saying it this morning that everything I used to get thrown out of school for, now they pay me to do.
Okay, I like it.
They do. Think about it. What do I do? What do I do all day professionally? Daydream, basically. Right, and you know, talk dirty and think about sex, and now they send checks,
pass notes,
notes,
right? I love it, and stick your tongue out at the teacher,
right? And because Sonny Mehta is my editor, there's no deadline.
That's true. You do have that ability to sort of pass by the deadly deadline.
Right, she's one of the few people on earth less mature than me, so you know. So
maybe it's because he drinks at your editorial conferences.
Could be.
Who can tell? Anyway, back to The Trail of Buddha's Mirror. So you've been there, and so it seemed like if Neil was going to be, in fact, a migratory outside the USPI, as he had started out to be, why not China?
Why not China? Why not China?
I thought you did a brilliant job putting him in that Hong Kong apartment, or, you know, the tenement complex or whatever it is. I've always remembered that, obviously, you may not, since you're getting a glazed look, but do you remember when he's chasing bad guys sort of over, you know, over interior bridges and through rooms and
all? Yeah, I just forget what it was called, but, and it's not there anymore. They tore it down.
Uh-huh.
So the Forbidden City, it's not there.
Well, I thought it was tremendously atmospheric and different and
a lot of
fun, and at the end, Neil does, in fact, go off up the mountain to enter the monastery.
The suspense is killing me. Tell me what happens.
I'll try to read you.
Oh, he goes into the monastery.
That's right.
That's right.
And we don't know when we exit that book whether that's it for Neil, you know, whether he's going to stay in the monastery and you're going to turn your hand to some new character. So there was a lot of suspense waiting for book three.
Yeah. I think it's just a fantasy of mine. You know, we used to stay at monasteries on those hiking trips. We'd stay at these insane Buddhist and Taoist monasteries that looked like something right out of Indiana Jones. We were the first Westerners allowed up that mountain since 1949.
Right. Well, there weren't a whole lot of mysteries with that background when you published it. Since then, we've had actually some very good. Elliot Battison's wrote that marvelous series about Tibet, which is kind of a step west of the Sichuan. And I myself have now been to that part of China, which I absolutely love.
It's great. Yeah.
It is great.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that that's always been sort of this fantasy of mine, this kind of withdrawal hermit fantasy, you know, that I could just go somewhere.
It's so not you. You know, I'm sorry, but it really isn't you.
It's how I live.
In your head.
But you know my wife and son. I mean, if I didn't live with them, I'd never see anybody.
Well, there's that. Well, actually, one of the other reasons I like the Trail of Buddhist Mirrors so well is it brought you to me.
That's right.
One of the landmark events in my bookselling career.
One of the landmark events in my book writing career.
It was so great. I still remember you came, and it was you and Nancy and me, and you know, and we talked about that book, The Trail. Now, interestingly enough, that is the book that actually had a second printing.
Is that right?
Yeah,
you
they
know
probably
these
published
I never
14.
Do.
You know,
yeah,
the
exactly,
first time.
12,
but
yeah.
Because I only have a second printing, which has annoyed me all this time.
I think they asked me how many members in your family are still speaking to you, and that's the number of books they printed.
That's
see,
an extremely pricey
small.
Book for people who collect books because the print room was so tiny. Usually, it's the first book that's the hardest to find and the most expensive. But in your case, it's The Trail to Buddha's Mirror.
Yeah.
But then you came storming back. Is the third book Way Down on the... Which is the third one?
Third book is, that's right, Way Down,
Way
on,
down
the,
on the
Western.
High, Lonely, which is the one up in, is it Wyoming?
Nevada.
Nevada.
Austin, Nevada.
Right. And it's a Western, and you've got all kinds of neat stuff. And,
yeah.
And Neil sort of begins to get a life in the sense that he makes a romantic connection in that
He does.
Way.
He meets a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you gave him a couple more cases, and then you just, like, abandoned him and wrote a book called...
The Death and Life of Bobby Z.
Which had a different title in England.
It did.
It
wasn't that one. It was, you're right, the next book I wrote was called, in America it was called A Winter Spy.
That's it.
But in England it had the real title that I put to it, which was...
I know it, I can't remember.
Isle of Joy.
That's it. Isle of Joy.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, The Winter Spy came out over here as like a paperback.
It did. They never published it in hardback. That was one of those, that was the trench.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it got orphaned, frankly, by its publisher. The editor left the house.
Oh,
and the next people who came in, you know, didn't get it. And, you know, it did really well in England. And it kind of started me in England, really. But, no, it didn't do anything here. And it also came out under a different author's name here.
That's right. And that was after, what was the title of the fifth Neil Carey? Something about the water slide up the...
Up the Down Water Slide. And
I'll look it up.
Thank you.
Because I'm having a hard time. I love your titles. I always have. But whoops. This is Random House, who
they
aren't
won't,
nice.
They,
and
won't
they only
publish
have
those.
The Death and Life of Bobby Z and California.
No, there was Up the Down
Line.
Water Slide, and While Drowning in the Desert was the last St. Martin's book.
That was it.
And that was the book that I'd forgotten to write. Do you remember that story?
Yes, I do. But tell us, because it's an interesting story.
My agent called up, and he said, are you going to get this book done? And I said, what book? And he said, you owe another book on this contract. And I was surprised, you know. And so he said, don't worry, I'll get you a 6-month extension. I said, no, I can do it. He said, it's due in 2 weeks. I said, I can do it. And so I set the phone down and just drank a lot of coffee. And we were living in this condo in Dana Point. You know, I was working as a PI in LA.
Right.
And went into the bedroom and came out 2 weeks later with a book.
Cave. This is when your lovely wife and son didn't actually see you. They just shoved food under the door.
My lovely wife was really cooperative and shoved food under the door. Yeah. Yeah. Almost literally, she'd open it up and, like, throw food in and close the door. You know, blah, 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 thinking, you know, God, what does this stupid kid do next? You know, well, does this?
I liked While Drowning in the Desert, although I think one could sort of see reading it that it was a wrap-up, you know, for Neil.
It was. You know, I never intended at that point to be a wrap-up, and I am going to write another Neil Carey. But it was written pretty quick.
Don't you think it was a wrap-up of that character arc? Don't you think there are character arcs within a larger character arc? And I felt like you'd come to the end of a a cycle for Neil, but you didn't close the door on another cycle for Neil.
I think that's exactly right. And another cycle begins for him when I pick that series up again. Yeah.
And, you know, it should go that way. Otherwise, you just wind up in, you know, like sitcom television. And nobody wants to do that.
Well, yeah, I got bored with it because you'd never write a third act.
Right. That's true.
You're always ending it in the second act, and then pretty soon you're writing the same book with a different set of facts. And because the publisher wouldn't let me take him overseas anymore.
Oh, okay.
After the Chinese book.
Right.
Because the next one I was going to do was going to be in Africa, actually, and they vetoed it, so I went to Nevada. Makes sense in a certain...
Right. Equally foreign.
Right.
To New York.
Exactly. Level.
You're so wicked. All right. Well, anyway, so Neil Carey has got 5 books, which may miraculously now become 5 movies.
Could do.
Which might actually give him rebirth in a way that neither of us could currently imagine.
Could ever have imagined.
Yeah. And you did get the Edgar nomination, which, you know, for a first novel and for a new writer is a hugely helpful thing.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
I've had 2 so far as the publisher.
Congratulations, I know you.
No kidding. I'm really, really pleased with it.
That's good
stuff. And we did win the Seamus Award for one in the LA Times Book Prize. So
I won the Seamus Award and didn't know I'd won it.
I'd forgotten that. Obviously, which one?
California Fire and Life.
Oh, that's right.
Because they called up the house, and Jean answered the phone, my wife, and they said, do you want this plaque? And she said, what plaque? She said, well, your husband won the Seamus Award like 1.5 years ago.
Oh, that's so right.
And she sort of shouts in, did you win the Seamus Award? No. You know, and then I called up my agent. He said, no, you didn't win it. We would have heard about it. But apparently it did. And then, like, 2 weeks later, this plaque came.
And that's an award for those of us who don't know, for the Private Eye Writers of America is the best private investigator.
Yeah.
Which, in your case, embraced the insurance guy.
Right.
Because it's not just a classic PI, but it can be an investigative journalist an insurance agent. It has a slightly broader definition, but it's actually a neat award to win.
It is. I was really proud
Dennis
of it.
Dennis Lange won. S.J. Roseanne. There's some really giant writers like yourself.
Who's a big pal of mine, you know, S.J. Roseanne.
Fabulous, isn't she?
Yeah, she's a terrific person. We did this sort of Penn and Teller bit at the Edgars because I didn't want to speak, and so I thought if we do this Penn and Teller thing, I could be Teller. And then CG would have to speak.
She fell for it
like a ton of bricks.
I'm sure she wanted to.
Sucker.
She actually likes doing that kind of thing.
Sucker. You know, but then I was out to dinner with her a while ago in New York, and we discovered a mutual fondness for early John Woo movies.
And there's a bond.
Seriously. And so the other day in the mail, a T-shirt arrived. It's hard-boiled, you know, an early John Woo movie T-shirt for me.
Excellent. Well, back to Bobby Z, because that was, I'm trying to think, I hate the word breakout book, but it was the book that went to a bigger audience from a bigger publisher, so
definitely,
we could at least say that.
Right.
And it was the marvelous, it was the caper, as I define caper, which means that you can have bad guys and good guys all rattling around together, and the whole object of the book is to figure out who's going to get away with what.
Right. For me, the whole object of the book was to amuse myself. I really thought my career was over after Isle of Joy, Winter Spy, and I wrote Bobby Z on a train.
Right.
You know, a commuter train.
Well, tell us about it, though. That's a neat story.
I was living in Orange County and working in downtown L.A., and it was 1-hour-and-40-minute train trip each way. And so I'd get a big cappuccino thing, and I'd read the New York Times, and then I had a laptop with me, and I said I'd write a chapter going up and a chapter coming back. So whenever the conductor said Union Station 10 minutes, whatever Bobby Z was doing at that moment, I wrapped it up.
I love it. No wonder it's just pacing.
Or jerky, depending on how you picture it. And I didn't think anyone was going to publish it. And my agent had said, you know, write the whole book. I'm not going to sell the, you know,
proposal. Right.
Thanks, yeah. And I'll sell it to the movies before I sell it to a publisher. I said, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. And I sent it to Jimmy, my agent, on a Tuesday. He sold it to Warner Brothers on a Friday and to Knopf on the following Monday.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
And is it going to finally become a movie?
It is finally going to become a movie.
That's so exciting. Now, that one's been, what, like 5 years in the works?
More than that, I think.
More than that?
Yeah. I don't know, time flies, a long time, not as long as Cool Breeze.
No.
You know, which, you know, since the Punic Wars has been.
Quite
a while.
The early 90s, but Bobby came out kind of in the middle to late 90s. So
sounds
been,
about right.
Yeah, it's been about, but of course, I mean, it's such an action. Actually, it's, if Elmore Leonard's kind of the gold standard for crime novels that get made into movies, there are a lot of Elmore Leonard kind of elements, I think, in Bobby Z. You know, snappy dialogue, you know, lots of action, big cast of characters, most of them up to no good. You know, it moves.
Yeah, again, my philosophy in writing Bobby Z was if it didn't amuse me, it wasn't going in there.
So what was the dilemma?
I just wanted to blow stuff up. And
sure, but what was the dilemma that you dropped your hero into in the beginning of Bobby Z?
He is a recidivist criminal. A breaking and entering guy, and as he says, the problem is not breaking and entering, the problem is breaking and exiting, which he can't seem to successfully do. And he happens to closely physically resemble a famous drug dealer named Bobby Z. Actually, the character's name is Tim Carney. And so Bobby Z's been kidnapped. There's an agent that has been kidnapped by Mexicans, and they would swap him for Bobby Z. But Bobby Z allegedly dies, and so they take Tim Carney instead. So his job is to impersonate this famous drug lord.
It's one of those Faustian bargains where they offer him his freedom, right?
Right.
If he cooperates in this deal and the face and all of it, and it works.
Thank you. You did a better job. He's a three-time loser, and they say, yeah, we'll just let you out. You imitate Bobby Z, you know, for a few seconds while we make this swap, and then the rest of it's your problem.
Right. It's kind of a wonderfully classic premise. I mean, Donald Westlake has done this, I think, and a couple. I've always loved the premise, and of course, it always goes wrong.
Right. Yes, it always goes wrong, and this goes badly wrong. And then he finds out that the real Bobby Z has a kid, a six-year-old kid, that starts sticking to him, and this girlfriend who loves him. And so suddenly he has this little family, and he's on the run from everybody, the cops, the drug dealers, you know, all kinds of folks, and has to work that out.
That's kind of a nice, well, you've got Gene and Tomas, so I guess it wasn't unreasonable that your guy, quote, Bobby, would acquire a lovely girlfriend and a cute little kid, and ferociously intelligent cute little kid, the kind that scares you to death, sort of like yours.
Yeah. When I heard Tomas, I picked him up from somewhere one day when he was three, and he gets in the car and he says, how was your day? Fine. What you been doing? Writing. Oh, yeah? How many pages?
Well, I mean, I remember our first event together really well, but the scariest part of it was not you. It was Tomas, who has lived in my mind. God, now he's 15, so, I mean, he must have been like 5 when I met him, or younger.
A little younger.
He might have been younger.
You gave him cookies.
Right.
Well, you gave me cookies, which is why I keep coming back.
I think he was like 3.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right.
It's been a really long and interesting time. Has he grown any more sympathetic with your career as you've gone along?
No.
I don't think so. He didn't look like a kid who'd mellow.
No, not a bit. He's been on a lot of film shoots with me and stuff. He kind of gets the business. But when he was 2, he was on a play telephone, and he was saying, no, no, no way, forget it, not a chance, no. And I said, Tomas, who are you talking to? He says, my agent, no, no.
He's actually like a parrot, isn't he?
Yeah,
probably learned that at the end.
He learned a lot of words. We've had to have conversations about that.
Yeah. Well, all right, so Bobby Z is actually going to be a movie. It was a wonderful book. I'm truly annoyed that it is currently out of print, but with any luck, maybe the movie will drive them into reprinting it so we can all read it.
More than luck, it's a done deal.
Good.
It comes out on Vintage Press in January of 2006.
That's so exciting.
It just signed it.
Great. Yeah. Well, we've missed it because it was a book. You met my staff member, Patricia, earlier today. Patricia would sell a copy if you even breathed. If it moved, it read Bobby Z was her attitude.
I appreciate it.
Which is great. And then you wrote California Fire and Life.
Right. Which came out of, you know, all the arson work I did. I didn't do arson. I mean, I was...
You mean when you weren't burning down houses, you were trying to figure out who did?
Who did, yeah.
Actually, we haven't talked about, you know, your career as a PI, because when I first met you, you were living in Connecticut, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You were out here, but you were living on the East Coast, and you were actually working as a investigator.
Mm-hmm.
You still do, don't you, occasionally?
Occasionally.
Not really? Kind of moonlight?
you know, there's some cases that go on for years and years, like 15 years.
Right.
And so I sometimes still consult because I'd have been the person who did some of the initial work X number of years ago. But, you know, it's the exception, not the rule anymore.
How did you go from ushering in a movie theater and being a safari guide to being a professional private inquiry agent?
When you work, well, I wasn't an usher, by the way. Let's clear this right up. I was an assistant manager.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
Okay.
You wore a hat.
I didn't ush, and I didn't have a flashlight.
But you didn't sweep out the back of the theater.
I counted cookies. No, you know, my first night on the job, the manager said, "You're not going to know what to do if I'm here. I'll be at the Blarney Stone." So he was across, you know, the street at the bar. And the ushers are kind of looking at me. I had no clue what to do. And there's a screamer in the balcony, a psycho screamer, ululating in the balcony. And this big Irish usher from Avenue U in Brooklyn says to me, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Throw him out." And I'm standing in the refreshment lounge below the balcony. There's a window so you can see the screen. Whomp!
Watched him fly by.
So this unconscious body is lying out in front of the refreshment stand in this shocked silence. You know, reverberates through this theater. And the usher says, "You told me to throw him out." Well, you know, for the literal-minded, I figured, this is great. This is a record even for me. I've had this job for 17 minutes before I'm going to get fired.
This was the lesson to you in management communication, right?
So I'm thinking, now what? You know, because I needed this job. So I had the usher, this is all probably actionable, I had the usher drag him out into the alley. And I woke him up.
Did you give him free popcorn?
No. I splashed water in his face. And I leaned over him and I said, "If I ever see you again, next time I'll have him kill you. Now get out of here." And that was it.
Fabulous. Yeah. Well, you were certainly efficient, so you must have held on to this job for a little while.
I did. But when you're an assistant manager in movie theaters, you learn all about theft. Because movie theaters are a glittering wall of light to disguise theft at 100 levels. Being the little Irish Catholic boy that I am, I'm too guilty to actually steal, but I certainly saw other people doing it, and I was eventually fired for actually turning in a set of legitimate statistics. You know, I turned in an actually honest box office report and was instantly fired. And a couple of years later, a buddy of mine took over a string of legitimate theaters on Times Square, and of course the staff were robbing him. And so I was brought into the detective agency that had the security contract on those theaters, because they were involved with stealing, as an undercover person, and then I just stayed in the business.
What a really neat segue. I like that. Because, yeah, you always were doing kind of an undercover role. I hadn't thought about how it came about.
I was an undercover for a long time. I was on the street in Times Square on a Sunday morning. This is before Mickey Mouse took Times Square over, and it's crack vials, and, you know, doing a surveillance, and I've been out there for days. And I had on, like, holy jeans, sneakers, no socks, two-day growth of beard, grungy sweatshirt, baseball cap, and watching these two guys waiting for this deal to go down. My partners were across Broadway in a construction site with the cameras and the mics, you know. And I'm just about to make this deal. I've been on this for weeks. And from behind me, I hear this feminine voice screech, "Don Winslow!" And it was this woman I went to school with at the University of Nebraska. And she's looking at me like, "We always knew you were going to end up this way, you know." So the quarry flee. I can look across the street. I see the guys packing up the equipment. I can hear in the earpiece them cursing, you know. Well, Sherry Patrick was her name, is trying to get me to an AA meeting. And or buy me a meal or something, you know. I'm saying, I'm fine, go away, you know. And it didn't work
out. Another trench, right. Why were you in New York at all?
Oh, I went there to be a writer.
Okay. Was this after you finished your master's degree at Nebraska?
It was between. You know,
between.
I was there for about a year and then that didn't work out, and so then I went to New York to be a writer. And I was a starving writer, so all my characters ate great meals. I found after a while all I could write about was food.
A rich fantasy life.
Yeah, right? Well, I've always had a rich fantasy life, thank God, you know. But so I'd write, you know, and then I had to actually get a J-O-B, and so that's how I got into the movie theaters, and then became
a detective. I mean, obviously your first published novel, well, I shouldn't say that, was your first published novel, The Mystery, A Cool Breeze?
It was. I was writing plays.
You were writing plays?
You know, my first two plays that I wrote were actually produced and did pretty well on sort of a collegiate circuit. But I was writing plays. I had no thought at that time of writing detective novels. I'd never read one, and knew nothing about them, and it wasn't in my head. Then a few years after becoming a PI, I started to read PI novels.
Right. Well, I mean, I can see once you got into that profession that it would suggest that a crime novel would be a good thing to do based on, you know.
When you're a PI, you have a lot of time to read.
Well, I guess you do, because nothing's more boring than just sort of staking out, right?
Nothing's more tedious.
Right.
Well, The Sound of Music, but other than The Sound of Music.
You've got the coffee cup, you've got the empty bottle to pee in, and you've got the bar.
Yeah, you've got Elmore Leonard and John McDonald and
women have
all
a much
boys.
Harder time, you know. Women are not engineered for sitting in cars for great periods of time drinking coffee.
I know this because one Halloween I went to a costume party in drag, and I will never do that again because of that issue.
Yeah, it is
it's
a real,
just miserable.
I think that's one reason there are more male undercover ops, so to speak, or more male surveillance.
I'd be a terrible drag queen.
But you're so cute.
Thank you, but I just can't deal with the accoutrement. Yeah.
So, back to Nebraska. You actually made a friend who's been important in your recent career.
Yeah.
A friend, but then he called you, what was it he called you?
Can I say it unto you?
Absolutely.
Damn it, Winslow. I thought that was my name.
And he was your
He
master?
Called, he was my, Pete Maslovsky that I wrote this Vietnam book with, or he really wrote that book.
Right.
I did a few scenes and a little bit here and there, but he wrote that book. Yeah, it was my master's thesis supervisor. He used to call me at like 12:45 in the morning. Damn it, Winslow, I told you that the semicolon belongs. That kind of thing.
I got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to fantasize his
And what
death.
Were you getting your master's in?
Military history.
Oh, good. So you could have had a little operation to take out Maslow, right?
Oh,
Maslovsky?
Please.
Sorry,
it was my constant, you know, obsession. Yeah, you know, I was allegedly an expert on the use of indigenous troops in counterinsurgency warfare.
How in the world did you acquire that expertise?
As a graduate student. And then,
in Brooklyn?
Huh?
I mean, you learned this in Brooklyn on the streets? Or?
I learned it in Africa in the bush.
Ah, I forgot about the safari guides.
Yeah.
Where did that come, before you went to graduate school?
After, just after. I was in I worked for the State Department for a brief period of time. And then, because that, you know, paid regularly and had benefits and things, I dumped it and became a safari guide.
What is it you call all these little breaks? I know you practiced this word on the plane, so I want to give you a chance to use it.
You're so nice to me. Hiatai, which I expect would be the plural of hiatus, but maybe it's not.
I don't, it's such a cool word. Of course,
hiatai.
It could be, you know, Watusi or something.
I know, it sounds like a tribe somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I like that when you drop that one.
There I was, surrounded by hiatai.
It sounded so cool when you dropped it on me earlier today. I thought we should reprise it.
I know, I practiced because, you know, I've been gone for a while and I figured I needed excuses. And
well, here you
one
are.
Hiatus didn't seem like enough.
No.
Multiple hiatai.
Well, you've had a lot. I mean, you've had a really interesting and kind of zigzaggy, you know, career path.
Yes.
But, you know, it's so great because for a writer, nothing is ever wasted, is it?
That is the rationale that I use now, you know, to make myself feel better about my checkered career, is that it's all been grist for the mill, as it were.
But don't you think it really has?
Yeah, I really do. Yeah.
I mean, I've always thought that was one of your strengths as a writer, is that you could pull stuff in for so many worlds and so much experience.
Yeah.
You couldn't write so authoritatively or so hilariously about stuff if you hadn't experienced a lot of it.
There's been a lot of experiences, and I guess that is a good thing. There are times I think it's not, you know. There are times I kind of think, God, you should have been a little bit more steady or something. But
yeah, but then you wouldn't be... I've had that kind of marital career in my husband, the last one, the good one,
okay,
says to me, you know, every once in a while, he says, you know, why regret it? He said, you wouldn't be here, you know, today with me if you'd done something different. And
right.
I've learned to accept that.
And
but that's because it's had a happy ending.
That's right.
And so have you. If we were both, like, back in the gutter or one of the guys in the movie house, you know, being dropped down over the edge from the psychotic screaming or something, we might repine.
It has been a happy ending, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And no one's more surprised than me.
Ditto.
Yeah, you know, I never expected to be happy. You know, I didn't think that was part of the package. I didn't think that was part of the deal that you got in life.
But haven't you noticed that a lot of people who have a smoother path early in life seem to all sort of fall apart later?
Yep.
And I think maybe if you sow your oats and do all that good stuff, and now when you get to a place where you can get it together, you're not driven by some impulse to go do it. I mean, you've been there, done that, and you can be now grateful for a quieter, better time.
I think that is so true, you know, and I married relatively late, although I've been married 20 years, you know.
I'm really impressed to hear that. 20 years recently.
Who could be 20 years with me, do you think? I mean, she's obviously insane, you know. It's a good thing I married someone who's clearly mentally ill, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't work out.
Well, you have these long breaks where you're either locked in a room being fed or off doing something, so maybe that's the secret
of
your happy.
Maybe that's the secret.
Yeah, well,
I'm very much a homebody.
You know, it is interesting. I will have been married to Rob 15 years
is that
in
right?
December. I mean, I've been married my entire adult life, you know, since
just
college.
Just to a number of people.
Yeah,
I know,
it's been serial marriages.
Serial marriages, exactly.
I can truly say that, you know, that I have appreciated Rob in a way that if I'd met him when I was young, I would never without all that other experience. And I'm sure that's true about you. You know, all those days you were hungry. Now when you get a great meal, there you are. And I can see you during that terrible fire in Julian, California, which you and your family, you know, experienced. When was that, last year?
A year and a half ago.
That, you know, you had a lot of skills you brought to the table in terms of survival from the fire. I was interested to hear about how you coped with so much stuff.
I tried. It was so strange. You know, we suddenly had this town, a third of which had disappeared in the blink of an eye, and we had a lot of homeless people and a lot of hungry people, and there were a bunch of us standing around. We didn't know what to do. I've never run a disaster operation before, but suddenly you had to.
It's kind of hard to imagine that, you know, in California, in the middle of America, there you could be in an area of total devastation, like a battlefield.
I never thought it possible. I thought that I would come back and maybe I could contribute by writing pamphlets or something, or PR things to say the town is still here, please come shop or come visit, you know, to repair the economy. I never dreamed that my job in life would be to try to get 2,000 bottles of drinking water a day from somewhere, get it up the hill, get it offloaded, get it distributed, you know, all these logistical kinds of things. You know, I was trained to plan for a war, and so in a certain sense that helped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of knew about chain of command, and you know, knew about those things, and so that helped. And, you know, not that I was in charge. I mean, there were a lot of people doing it, but it was just a bunch of us who'd never done anything like it before, and we had to make it up as we went along, and the learning curve was ferocious.
What was your communication system?
Hello! A lot of times. We had no power and no telephone service, so we had cell phones that we all had. But then, of course, they'd run out of batteries, so we'd stick them in a bag at the end of the evening, run them down the hill to suburban San Diego, plug them all in, and bring them back in the morning. But I had a high school dropout that would sit on a hill overlooking the highway with a walkie-talkie. And I had the other walkie-talkie at the relief center. And when he saw the truck that had the water coming up, he'd radio me. It was, you know, it's crazy. And then I would send a runner over to the cider mill that had the only forklift in town. And they'd bring the forklift to the truck so we could offload the cases of water and then put pallets at sort of strategic corners so that people could come and get drinking water.
And that's how you avoided typhus and all. I mean, you know, going back into history, so often after some disaster like that, the drinking water contamination, you know, led to such terrible disease that people died more from that than they ever did from the actual catastrophe.
Yeah,
so you managed to escape that. Tell me again the story of the phone call you got from the Oriental person and how that went, because I think that's totally fascinating.
A couple of days after the fire, the temperature dropped to the 30s. We're on a mountain, and we were trying to find warm clothes, particularly coats for people. And I called on these cell phones that I described every department store that had an outlet in the San Diego area. And the answer was always the same. They had given very generously to a large organization, but the problem was the large organization wasn't there. It was one of the most desperate days of my life. I don't do failure well. And it started to get dark, and it was cold. And we had people, the soles burned out of their shoes. Some people in some areas had 5 minutes to get out. And so one of the phones rang. And this sort of clearly Asian dialect gets on, a woman, and says, "Hello, I would like to see some devastation." Of course, I got angry. You know me. And I mouthed off to her. I said, "Lady, that's the one thing we got plenty of. Come on up." Never expecting to see. And I'm angry. Thinking, tourists? This is what we've got now? Tourists? You know? Two and a half hours later, a van pulls up in front of the relief center. And it would have been a cruel ethnic joke if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. Chinese person after Chinese person after Chinese person gets out of this van. 15, 20 of them maybe? With uniforms, blue caps, blue vests, and bags carrying blankets and coats. And the woman clearly in charge, and you know, you look at those faces, woman's in charge, and I could tell she'd seen a few things in her life. Mm-hmm. Walks up to me, and I'd been there for 3 days, and I was exhausted. I gotta tell you, I was stressed out to the max. And puts her hand on my shoulder and says, "Honey, it's going to be all right." And I always choke up when I tell this story. And she said, "We'll be back tomorrow, and for as long as you need us. And we have $500 in cash for everyone who lost a home, and we have clothing, and we have food." And they were, and they did. And the light in that room changed.
And what did they turn out to be?
They were a group that had been started by a Buddhist nun in Taiwan in the mid-1960s, sort of a Buddhist Mother Teresa, because she had thought that the problem with Buddhism was that they weren't socially active enough. It was too introspective. And they needed to change that. And these people go to disasters all over the world. And they had an office in Mira Mesa, which is San Diego. And up they came. And it was saved.
That's a marvelous story.
Yeah.
And since you've done this one terrific book called Looking for a Hero with Pete
Maslowski.
Your
goddamn
university,
Winslow.
That's right,
right,
for the University of Nebraska guy, which is about Staff Sergeant Joe Ronnie Hooper, the most decorated guy of the Vietnam War. Maybe at some point you'll write about the Buddhist sister. But tell me a moment before we talk about Power of the Dog about Looking for a Hero, which is just a superb book.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really proud of that book. Pete and I became friends after I actually finished my master's degree.
After you exited the university.
Yeah, successfully, to the surprise of a lot of people, including Pete and including me. And when we lived in Connecticut, he's an avid and very skillful fisherman. And we lived in a trout fishing area, and Pete used to fly out, and we'd go trout fishing, and I'd hook trees and tree limbs and the boat and myself, and Pete would catch trout. You know, it was good. And he mentioned this guy, Joe Ronnie Hooper. He read a newspaper article, and he said, "I might write a scholarly article about this." And I said, "Pete, that's not an article, it's a book." "Oh, no, it isn't, Winslow." And about 3 hours later, he flies back to Lincoln, and I get a phone call saying, "You're right, it's a book, but I want you to write it with me." And so we spent 10 years writing and researching that book.
Wow.
Because nothing, not a single fact in the newspaper article that started all this turned out to be accurate, including the spelling of Hooper's name.
So your investigative skills really charged to the fore in this project, right?
This is the best investigative work I've ever done. Just tracking people down. You know, we knew he'd been married for 6 months in 1958, and we knew the woman's first name, and that was all. And it took 4.5 years to find her, and we did.
And you actually found her?
I did. I actually found her.
You got to call her up and...
My hand was shaking when I picked up that phone. If it wasn't her, I was out of leads.
Right.
And B, what if she wouldn't speak to us?
Which there was a really good chance would be the case.
If you knew the way Joe treated her, it was really a
possibility. He was a real womanizer, wasn't he?
An incredible womanizer. But, you know, he didn't chase women. He just seemed to have this magnetism.
Exuded pheromones or whatever.
Whatever that is,
yeah.
You know, those pheromones I've tried to buy repeatedly on 800 numbers. He had them. And so, you know, they really did. They kind of came to him. Incredible womanizer. And the book is really a love story in a lot of ways about a woman who was a Bob Hope girl in Vietnam named Carolyn DeVore, who was one of the loves of his life, and then eventually his wife, Faye. So it's about the most decorated veteran of the Vietnam War and why nobody ever heard of him.
Right. Well, he died of alcoholism, didn't he?
Indirectly. He died of actually sort of a time bomb from a wound in Vietnam.
Oh.
He'd been shot in the head, and he had an aneurysm.
Oh.
But he had stopped drinking for a number of months. And then the Veterans Administration sent him a letter saying, your benefits are canceled, and you owe us $18,000. And he went off to the Kentucky Derby to try to win it. While he was gone, another letter came saying, oops, mistake, you benefits are fine, and you don't owe us $18,000, but Joe had already started drinking. And in the shower, in the wee hours of the morning, the aneurysm exploded, and he died.
It was never entirely clear from what you've turned up that the letters of recommendation or, you know, the accounts of the, what was it, during the Tet Offensive?
Yes.
That he won the Medal of Honor, although he's obviously a really brave guy. But didn't you say that, you know, it was difficult to, signatures weren't necessarily authentic and the people?
They were absolutely not authentic. You know, one of the first things we did when we started the book was to get the Medal of Honor file. And in that file are eyewitness statements,
right,
which are signed. And we read it and went, my God, what a marvelous thing. And this is going to be very easy to write. Look at all these eyewitness statements we have. We interviewed every eyewitness. In fact, we interviewed every survivor of that battle from his unit. None of them had written those statements, and the signatures were all forgeries.
How'd you account for that? Was it some giant conspiracy, or was it just the
middle-level conspiracy? There was tremendous pressure to produce medals and good PR from Vietnam, and so they made the statements up. Now, probably most of the things, but by no means all of the things that they said he did. But even Joe didn't remember it.
Right.
And
there must have been consensus that he'd been heroic, even if they couldn't remember exactly how.
He'd been absolutely heroic. There's no question about that, and his heroism went above and beyond. But there are some things in that file he definitely did not do that other people did. Joe woke up one day early in his second tour in Vietnam and said to a friend, you know, I guess I did all the things they said I did. I just sort of came to, and they were patting me on the back and calling me a hero.
Well, you know, people who are in terrible accidents and all never can remember the stuff all around them. So, I mean,
right,
it's not actually surprising he wouldn't remember. That I can understand. It's a little surprising that observers would, you know.
Well, remember that every observer was also a participant.
Well, that's true.
And in battle, you're not sort of standing there looking
taking
around
notes,
seeing what's happening. You're getting as low to the ground as you can and hoping that nothing hits you. And that time and memory compression was the same for everybody.
Right.
Some people describe that battle to us as lasting a few minutes, others as hours. Some had the days wrong. Some had people there who could not have been there because they'd been killed the day before. None of them were lying. There's a whole chapter in the book about memory and how it works and the biochemistry of heroism.
Right. And the problem with expert witnesses in court. I mean, sorry,
absolutely,
not expert witnesses, the problem
precipient
with eyewitnesses,
right,
and so forth in court. Which
that's right.
Is, yeah, you're right.
Which is the same problem. And as an investigator, of course, I'd run across that many times.
Sure. You know, before we run out of time, let's talk for a moment about Power of the Dog, this
okay,
magnum opus that we both skillfully avoided it like the elephant in the room here. Started out as
skillful avoidance is one of my main life skills. So,
well, we got 4 minutes to
okay,
nail it down. So it started out as a story based on what?
A massacre that happened in Ensenada of 19 men, women, and children by a drug cartel. And the whole book came out of an attempt to explain how that could happen.
And it turned out, I mean, you sat down to write one of your sort of novels. And
yep,
what did it turn out to?
It turned out to be an epic that follows five characters across the course of 30 years and is a history, really, of the drug wars from 1975 until the present. I call it my magnus opus, therefore.
The magnus opus,
yeah,
right. I like that. And when you finally turned it in, what size was it?
You're going to make me say this on television?
I am.
2,000 pages, give or take.
I love it.
2006.
And when Sonny Mint has sent you his editorial letter of two words saying, cut it,
yeah.
What was your response?
How?
Well, your response was you were going to make it...
Longer.
I love it. But what you actually did was cut it, what, like in half?
In half, yeah.
And then you and Sonny had to whittle away at it.
We had a 7-hour face-to-face editorial meeting at Sonny's apartment in New York.
I find this so fascinating, as you and I have talked about, because, you know, as a publisher myself, if I'd been presented with this, see, my absolute inclination would have been to cut it into two books.
I know.
And, you know, I'm just so baffled by the fact, I mean, Brandon, I just did a panel in New York, and the panel for a whole organization was two people, Jonathan Karp, the editor-in-chief of Random House,
right.
And me, the editor-in-chief of Poison Pen Press, which was a David and Goliath moment if ever there was one.
Sure.
But nevertheless, you know, I just keep wondering why, you know, they wouldn't have seen that this could have been a really magnificent two-part, larger story. So I guess part of the question is, maybe you and I at some point should talk about making it a larger two-part story.
We should. We could do that. You could talk with Sonny about it. A CD sort of thing. That'd be fun.
Or maybe inspire Random House to do it. Because, you know, in truth, if you think about it, it'd be sort of like doing all the outtakes. You know, you have the DVD of the movie, and then you have all the outtakes.
All the outtakes.
Except in your case, the actual book would be the smallest part of the outtakes. I mean, it'd be a 25% ratio, but still.
Something like that. You know, the book's not an abridged book by any means.
No.
And when I did this last draft, I really sat down and said, this is the draft I'm doing. And this is the story, and these are the characters, and this is the book. So it's whole unto itself, and I'm happy with the book.
Absolutely.
I like the book. But it was a tough process. Sonny, too.
I like the book, too. And but you've mentioned there was like a whole story that you excised in one, like a 200-page story, which is actually a book by itself.
Right.
That came out, and that still exists.
Yeah, the Chiapas section.
So, you know, it's possible, I guess, that some chunks of this can float into other books, but it might be interesting. No?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it might be interesting to the other thing, but I don't see that as coming into another book. But, you know, I would put it out, I'd put it in and take it out, and then, you know, when Knopf annoyed me, then I'd put it back in and
so
send it back just to see if they noticed.
I love that part of it, too. Did it change you as a writer to write a book of this size and subject matter?
Changed me as a writer, and I think it changed me as a person. You know, I'm noted for my superficiality. You know, as I've said, you know, my shallowness knows no depth, knows no bottom. So this is kind of a deep book, and it's kind of a thoughtful book, and it's a book about
good and evil. Yeah.
It's a book about redemption.
Right.
You know, it's a book about people trying to live decently in an indecent world.
And it's a wonderful and sympathetic look at people south of the border, which one doesn't always get this side of the border.
Right.
I mentioned earlier that Luis Alberto Urrea has written a book called The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's almost like you guys, and it's another big book, have sort of doorstopped, you know, bookended a subject.
Well, I'd be honored to be a bookend with him, yeah.
Yeah, well, for sure.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he should feel that way about you, because the two books together are kind of like bigger in a way, she says, having just read them both, than the two books separately. I mean, each of them is a tremendous and magnificent work, but together they're really an extraordinary picture, I think, that we don't often get. And we're so close, you in California and us in Arizona, to the Mexican border, that I think it's grand that you guided us over it.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that culture and those people. And we sometimes just take them for granted, or we just see them as the gardener.
As a problem, or
as
whatever.
As a problem, when we don't see them in all their variety and complexity. You know, I'm absolutely convinced that everybody's story is interesting.
And you were put here to write some of them.
I was.
You were.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Always been a pleasure. I wish we hadn't run out of time.
It's always great to see you.
You too.
Okay.
And I thank all of you, once again, for watching us on The Criminal Calendar. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.